safe and sound at home again. Let the waters roar, Jack.
Long we've tossed on the rolling main, now we're safe ashore, Jack. Don't forget your old shipmates. Rally, 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 ride, oh.
We have worked the self-same gun, quarter-deck division. Sponger, I unloader you through the whole commission.
Long we tossed on the rolling main, now we're safe ashore, Jack. Don't forget your old shipmates. Rally, 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 ride, oh.
Episode 84 of the Cult Matt and Mark Cult Film Review Podcast. I'm Matt.
And I'm Mark.
And make sure to visit our blog at cultfilmreview.blogspot.com or shoot us an email at cultfilmreview@gmail.com. Show news. Got any show news this week?
I really haven't watched any movies during my vacation. It seems like I've been busy shoveling gravel around my driveway. I'm starting to think now that I really should have rented that little mini bobcat to do the job.
Yeah, I mean, for a four-hour deal, it'd probably run you a couple $100 and you'd be done with it.
Yeah, it would have been a good idea. But now I gotta buy. I like how when you think about gravel, you think it's not worth anything. But when you just need to buy a pile of gravel, somehow it costs $250.
Yeah, that's the way it works. Now, I've been shoveling diapers and I procreated, so our arrival showed Miriam Sky Rivette is in the house this evening, soundly asleep. Let's hope for this hour. We're doing this at Betty time, so I'm hoping. So keep your fingers crossed, folks. Actually, we'd probably just edit it, so it would seem seamless if there was a domestic disturbance here. So
a domestic disturbance. Oh my goodness gracious.
Oh, that's the wrong word, isn't it? domestic interruption. How about that? Yeah, domestic disturbance means cops are showing up. So,
yeah. Have there been any cops?
A cop does live across the street. He introduced himself the other night. It's good to know. All right, this week our film is Master and Commander: The Far Side of the World, starring Russell Crowe as the famous literary hero Jack Aubrey, lieutenant in the Royal Navy. Quick plot rundown here. The Far Side of the World is based on two Napoleonic War-era adventure novels and author Patrick O'Brien's Aubrey Maturin series, Master and Commander and The Far Side of the World. Russell Crowe stars as Captain Jack Aubrey, a high seas adventurer who maintains a strong bond with ship surgeon Stephen Maturin, played by Paul Bettany. After conquering much of Europe already, Napoleon's forces have set their sights on taking Britain, so Aubrey and the crew of his ship, the HMS Surprise, take to the Pacific to intercept any attacking ships from the French fleet. When Aubrey eyes a renegade French super frigate, the Surprise pursues, leading to an adrenaline-charged chase through the distant reaches of the sea. There you go. There you have it. Short enough for you?
Yeah, that sounds about right. It is sort of a hybrid of the works of the author. It doesn't really follow any one of the books in particular.
It had nothing to do with the books at all, other than characters and maybe some relationships there and era.
It did, but they sort of pieced things together. I'm not familiar with the books. I just did a cursory look around, but I think people generally think it caught the spirit of the books pretty well, and certainly could have been carried on.
Yeah. No. Well, it leads at the end. It obviously segues to what you would imagine to be a perfect sequel, but then we're just left to wonder, which actually is kind of nice. I don't mind it.
No, me neither.
You do get the impression that they do catch up to the Acheron and deal with the ruse appropriately, since there's basically, what, one or two surviving officers, including the captain on that ship, as it's heading out, right?
I thought that was more of just sort of a fanciful take, like they're going to have a little mini adventure at the end, which is sort of cute that they don't show.
Sort of cute. So this is one of your favorite films, I guess, and it's
recent.
This is 2000.
Yeah, it's pretty recent. I mean, I think generally it's a real solid, it's really an action adventure movie more than anything else.
I wouldn't consider it historical. I mean, it is, but it's more, it kind of seems like It's in the guise of historical, but it's actually heavy-duty action-adventure.
Oh, yeah, it's super action-y. I mean, it doesn't burn itself with reality too much. It's weird. I guess supposedly people say, and I know nothing about tall ships, but the way they represent the tall ships and how the seamen handle the ship and some of the shots of life there are very accurate. But the movie itself lets itself be fanciful with how some of the action takes place and how quickly people recover from terrible injuries and whatnot.
Yeah.
Time is sort of accelerated. They're not a slave to realism beyond sort of the portrayal of life on a tall ship.
I got the impression watching it that basically half the hold is full of timber and half the crew are master carpenters, because they do sort of this organic self-repair out in the middle of the ocean and are able to refit the tall ships for continued adventure without much of a problem. You know, at night they're all sitting around with the fiddles and cellos singing songs and sea shanties and, you know, on with it. And I was thinking, really, you can take like a cannonball to the side and patch it, or you can take a severn mast and somehow re-rig it. I guess maybe that's just master seamanship. Maybe that's something they did back then. But to me, that seemed fanciful, that you're just like, oh, just, you know, they're even out there chiseling the figurehead or the bowsprit or whatever that carving is.
Well, you know, in olden days, I mean, right now, the artist is sort of honored by our society, the creative type. But I think in the past, at least in the, you know, historical past, the artist was a rather lowly position in society. It was sort of like a roofer. It was just part of it was just a manual labor type job.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. There, I think art now has, and I don't know if it's has to do with the fact that money has somehow inserted itself into art or craftsmanship to a point that we don't think of the lowly artisan as kind of a, I don't know, station in our culture.
But it'd be funny. I bet if you talk to a lot of artists, I think their station as far as money goes is still pretty lowly unless they break through.
Right. Yeah, but they like cocktail parties and stark modern galleries with moneyed beneficiaries swanking it up. They like that kind of thing. I don't think they like...
Well, they sort of have to. I mean, who else is paying several $1,000 for wall art? Not somebody living in an apartment complex in the bad side of town, I'll tell you that.
That's true. So I guess in this case, you have people building ships or repairing ships on the high seas.
And... the repair thing is a little outside of realism. I mean, how many times did they totally paint this ship? And how much paint did they bring with them? Yeah, they have to, after they make the big repairs after the first fight, they have to basically fix the whole ship at sea and paint it. And then they paint it another color when they do their whale ship stick bug disguise.
Yeah, right. Stick bug disguise. Does that ever happen in real life? Do military commanders look wistfully off at some panorama of nature and come to a epiphany, a eureka moment where they're like, I know how to defeat thine enemy, and off they go.
Oh, I just got a new idea for making war. We'll use misdirection in disguise.
Yeah. I think Sun Tzu beat Russell Crowe or the Aubrey character about 3,000 years before that
But you know, I forgive the movie that stuff. This is sort of where it plays fast and loose with reality.
Well, let's be honest. Napoleonic era wars were not guerrilla affairs. They were toy soldiers almost out on the battlefields. They were a brightly colored, standard waving, drummer induced affairs that I don't even know how you would fight those tactically. We always think of wars now as guerrilla operations of camouflage and you know, sort of our modern warfare.
Well,
ideals.
You know, maybe they didn't, especially at sea, maybe they didn't use misdirection. And they, maybe this wasn't a common tactic to try to disguise yourself as some other boat or run a false flag. So, in a sense, maybe he was thinking outside of the box as the box existed during that time.
I think he was. And I think you didn't get a lot of that sort of, I don't know, what we consider modern warfare engagement until the industrial era.
Maybe it wasn't considered honorable.
I think honor had a lot to do with the bullshit wars of those eras. You know, I mean, I think where that all fell apart was like in the Civil War, where you had some industrialization going, but you were fighting battles similar to the Napoleonic era. You'd line up your forces on one side, and then you just kind of go at it, sort of like fisticuffs.
I think the wheels really came off during World War One.
Yeah, World War One was definitely where it all changed. Yeah,
well, where they hit the brick wall, and they decided maybe we should basically use whatever tactic works instead of just lining up and throwing meat into the grinder.
Exactly. What I did like about this film, though, it definitely shows you a visceral battle between the tall ships that you don't ever really get in film. And I haven't watched a lot of historical cinema that may have tried to recreate these battles. But there's definitely some blood and guts and gunpowder and chaos. And it's fun to watch, especially that last battle. You get the impression, it's like, hey, man, this might be how this sort of thing went down. And I like that, you know, to the Marines, like, tumbling onto the deck and skewering any fucker they saw and, you know, point-blank cannon fire at the waterline and all that stuff.
This movie has just some great sound editing. I don't know if you've ever had a chance. Not this time, I just watched it on my TV upstairs, but one of the times I watched this before, I watched it downstairs when I had my home theater set up, not totally dismantled, with the surround sound. And some of the sound work on this is incredible. When you're inside the ship and there's wood splinters flying.
Oh, the wood splinters. Sound,
it almost makes it worth hooking those speakers up behind you. Almost.
Almost, man. Hooking shit up, I tell you, it's a half the barrier for enjoying things, especially when I have to turn on my Xbox and hit like a sequence of five or six buttons and wait a period of 30 seconds to boot anything up. I want to kill myself. That's terrible.
Oh, the Jesus. Modern world, it's a terrible burden.
Oh, it is. Yeah. So the battles were... I guess you just had I like this film so much is you just don't see that. You mm-hmm. haven't seen it. And it gets you to a point in history. And, of course, I'm sure it's probably fanciful and exaggerated. But still, it was kick-ass, like, you know, kick-ass historical battles that kind of get your blood moving. And they're not all these hyper-stylized, modern filmmaking je ne sais quoi, like the Bourne movies with the shaky cam and the hyper editing and all that kind of stuff. You know, it's
the editing's pretty reserved, and a lot of great character development too. On top of all this action, which is just masterfully shot.
What I liked, or I thought was interesting, and I don't know if it came out the same year, but Russell Crowe starred opposite Paul Bettany in A Beautiful Mind.
Oh, about the same time, yeah.
Yeah, he played his imaginary friend in, I forget, his imaginary roommate. Mm-hmm. The Russell Crowe character played the schizophrenic savant character. So, yeah, and I thought their chemistry worked well. And I guess Russell Crowe, he's a kind of a bastard to work with. I maybe that's just the impression that he gives. Maybe he's a real down-to-earth professional when it comes to... the movie set or something, but he definitely had a good chemistry with all his co-stars, I thought. Mm-hmm. And especially the young kid, which I found this movie extremely interesting because the officer class was made up of teenagers and 20-somethings, which you guess are products of aristocracy. Or
they're moneyed individuals that send their probably their lesser children off to to gain fame and honor in the military. But there's also children in among the conscripted seamen,
right,
too.
And there's a nice sort of, I guess, multi-ethnic vibe going on. You get black Africans along with white folks and maybe a myriad of other ethnicities in between, all serving on the same ship.
Do you remember when the British Empire outlawed slavery?
Before we did.
Yeah, but was it at this time, were the black members of the ship, this is supposed to take place in 1802, were they freemen or were they slaves? I think they might have been freemen.
I'm trying to think. I don't know. I could look it up, but I know, like Amazing Grace, the song Amazing Grace was written by a former British slaver. I don't know when that was. Liverpool was actually a slave ship yard. They built most of the slave ships for the New World. But I don't know when they actually outlawed it. I know they did it much before we did, as most of progressive things Britain has trumped us on. we've somehow we revolted and decided we're just going to stay in the past as long as possible and let Britain sort of push ahead with progression and adopt the better parts later on when we see fit or not. You know,
well, we still had they didn't really have an economic interest in slavery, and we still did. So
Theirs true.
Was the easier decision, I think.
We had a vast continent of agricultural land to harvest.
Look, so that cotton's not going to pick itself.
That's right.
So talking after that terrible comment.
Yeah, right.
Getting back to the child soldiers here for a second. How about Max Berkus's portrayal of the young officer Blackney?
Is he the one that lost his arm?
Yeah, that's the one who lost his arm. Can you imagine what that guy will be like as an adult? After this harrowing 9-month mission, he comes back without an arm, sees like two of his friends die in front of him. That is going to be one hard motherfucker.
No, as I was watching that, I was like, that little fucker is born again hard, man. He's like, born again hard.
Can you imagine that guy at like 45? Holy shit, he's going to be like a diamond.
Let's see, at 45, let's say he was, I don't know what, give him the benefit of the doubt, 14.
Here? I doubt he was even that. He must have been like 11 or 12.
Yeah, he'd be like one of those grizzled officers that they sent down to Africa to man the colonial stations of, Tanzania or wherever the fuck the British were at the time. That kid is, you can only imagine how hardcore he's going to be.
And he's a kind soul, too, so he'll be like an honorable hard man. He'll be hard, but he won't be petty. You know?
Right.
He'll be hard. He'll have rules, but he'll also pat you on the head, too, after he gets
done.
He'll
be a bit of a...
giving you 30 lashes for disobedience.
That's right. Well, that's just
going to hurt me more than it hurts you.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Well, that's what I found so interesting about the film is that you get that impression, and he's given orders to old grizzled fuckers below deck about what they're going to do during the attack, and with complete confidence. And I was like, that's all it takes in this world. It's a little confidence.
And the right parents doesn't hurt.
And the right, the right title in English aristocracy, and you're good to go.
But you just think about it, you think, I'm an aristocrat, so you wonder, I'm going to have a nice life of leisure, I'll be fucking the servants and getting fat on fine game. But the fact, at 11 years old, your fucking parents put you on a boat where you get your arm blown off.
Well, but see, Britain has a much different, I guess, class, what's the right word, outlook than we do. And there is high responsibility with being a titled individual or being a personage of class in Britain. And we don't get that here. Here, when you get rich and, I guess, landed, or whatever equivalent version we have, you get a free ticket to fuck off and get a cocaine habit. But in Britain, at least historical Britain or the Britain that maybe this movie is more representative of. You had duties, and one of your duties was to serve a king, queen, and God and country. And you get that even with the royal family. I mean, the two princes, the princes always have to serve in some military capacity for a period of time. And they serve humbly, and they serve without question, which I always found somewhat endearing, even though the royal family is a bit of a sea anchor, if you will, on the whole British economy to a certain extent. But I at least found it respectable. And I think in sort of the class system that you see represented in this movie, you get that as well. And I don't think there's any resentment. I don't think there's a whole gluts of these kind of officer folks who escape duty. I think it was noble, and I think it was an attractive way to an attractive lifestyle that everybody kind of wanted to emulate, regardless of how horrible it was.
I tell you, having your parents throw you in to be an officer at 12 is probably better than being shanghaied as an able seaman at 12.
Exactly. Yeah, right.
Which you saw plenty of them on there, on the boat, too.
I think they called those folks press-ganged. I don't know where that term came from.
I think they were, they were basically conscripted to fill the sort of the labor force of the Navy, which I guess is part of war making. You conscript your lower class to be the muscle of your armies.
That's the way it goes. Well, I mean, just head over to Russia and get that right now.
I mean, we conscript the lower class in different ways in our military too.
Yeah. Well, yeah, of course, as Noam Chomsky would say, our military is a mercenary army of the poor. So
it'd be nice to see at least in this Navy, the wealthy individuals are forced into labor.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah, that's a little better bit more food. Progressive. Better food. Yeah, I always liked how they had the cannon deck, right?
Uh-huh.
And then like a set, they would like put up the bulkhead walls, and then you would have Jack Aubrey's officer quarters and dining.
Oh, the great
area.
Room. Yeah.
Yeah. And
they show that twice where they just come in with the walls and just put them in place.
Yeah. And then he sits down and somebody hands him some wine and the candles go up and, it's time for bullshitting and storytelling.
I always liked his steward, Killick. I thought that was a really neat character. The guy was always cooking. That was sort of the grumpy looking steward to the captain who was always cooking something. With the black guy in the back room or making a pudding.
Can
you imagine the food aboard that vessel? Oh, God.
Well,
I just think about how bad the food must have been. Oh, Jesus.
And
Christ.
How sick you would have gotten from it constantly. Oh. And, they drank wine because wine has been sort of a standard in Western European culture and food for millennia because. Wine and cass, you can actually get hydrated from it, and it manages to keep a lot better than just water.
The 6% or 8% alcohol in it keeps bacteria from growing. So it keeps it sterile, basically.
And somehow you don't get – it's not a diuretic at that point. I don't see how they could get hydrated from it, but – I think they were able to, and that's why they drank a lot of wine, and I think that's why they show that in the film.
Well, probably is a pretty good choice of some vitamins, probably some citric acid, maybe some vitamin C.
Keep the scurvy away.
Yeah,
all that
I bet
good stuff.
It's probably just good energy, too. It's got a lot of sugar in it.
But yeah, trying to cook on a ship that's been out to sea for 6 months with no refrigeration, it's got to be...
The food just has got to be so terrible, and especially for the seamen. Eating off their wooden plates.
Eating the same shit day in,
I mean,
day
what
out.
Are you eating? I still don't understand what they ate. They showed some bug-infested bread, and that was the officer food.
That was right. The lesser of two weevils, which was a pretty good joke, by the way.
Yeah, it was pretty solid.
It was funny, yeah.
There were some pretty nice scenes where everybody's just chit-chatting. That's what, and there's something about sea shanties I find really... entrancing. I don't know what it is, but I mean, I really enjoyed it in Jaws, and here I've seen it again.
So
maybe
you
should
catch
get into
the same,
sea shanties.
The same sea shanty was shantied in this film as was in Jaws.
Oh, Gene pointed that out to me. I didn't quite recognize it. Yeah.
The Ladies of Spain or something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So and much better with the whole crew of British officers singing it than, what was Quinn? Was Quinn from Jaws? Is that the guy's name?
Yeah, I think he was singing that after the, man goes in the cage goes in the water,
yeah, right.
Shark's in the water.
Right.
Business.
Yeah. So anyway, but it was a fun depiction. And you're just glad you were like, it was nice to just see a window into it and know that you would never have to live a life like that.
Oh, yeah. That little, living all those guys. And that was sort of a smallish warship, I believe.
Yeah.
Compared to some of the warships out there. It just had a
The Atron, here's to U.S. military ingenuity, was a Yankee vessel built in the shipyards of Boston. And I don't know if you caught that one or not. But
Yeah. Oh, yes. Certainly the plight of those two seamen. They did not turn out well, that friend duo. There's the friends. There's two of the guys on the two of the seamen on the boat are friends, and one of the guys from Boston, right? And they remember they come and see Captain Jack, and they give him the model of the Acheron because one of the two saw it, and the other guy's an amazing model maker.
Yeah, no.
He just whipped out this amazing detailed model.
Did he whittle that fucker?
How yeah, you know, he just went down to their tremendous timber stores deep in the basement, picked off a couple of planks and whittled that bitch out in all his free time when he's not scrubbing the deck and hanging rigging. The one friend has to kill the other friend when he falls overboard by cutting his rope loose.
Oh.
Those are the two guys. Yeah. And then the guy who cut his friend loose ends up getting killed during the big boarding exercise late in the film.
And one of them
neither
whipped.
Of those kids turn out.
One of them was whipped for insubordination as well.
Oh, yeah. After he gets whipped, he gets killed. Yeah, so those poor sons of bitches. Future was so bright for them.
Not really. I think their number would have come up eventually. Like all those guys, their number would have come up eventually. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. That scene at Cape Horn, I think if you're doing a tall ship movie, I remember as a kid watching some black and white with my dad and Storm on Cape Horn. It's like you have to have that set piece in there. Or you get thrown out of the tall ship adventure club, filmmaking club. If you don't have it in there, people were waiting for it. It's like, where is it? You got to do it. So for whatever reason, that has to be in there. And Cape Horn, it's just a little island off of Chile, I think. I think it's Chilean. But then there's the Straits of Magellan, which I wonder why folks don't traverse more often. But it's like a channel. That's a little bit further north that weaves you through the southern part of the continent. That doesn't seem as bad.
Maybe it's more dangerous because of how much. Maybe there's some shoals or something that you could run up against.
I'm sure it sucks. Yeah, but that seems great.
That is great. You know, it's actually one of the more confusing parts of the movie where I think this had a bit of a long running time, about 2 hours 10 minutes.
Oh, did it?
And I mean, it goes fast. It's a fast 2 hours 10 minutes because it has a good pace. And it keeps rolling pretty quick, and generally it's edited very well. But this part where they come to Cape Horn and sort of they get down to the southern latitudes and with the rough seas, it's a little confusing because remember it happens right when they make that daring night escape with the false ship.
They put a decoy out. It's kind of cool.
Which probably wouldn't have worked. Let's just be that was they took some license with that, right?
Oh, come on, man. They didn't have radar.
Probably if you're getting chased by another ship at night, you probably wouldn't put a bunch of lanterns on your ship just so they know exactly where you were in the middle of a moonless night, right?
To be honest, if you're out in the deep ocean, you're going to have enough ambient light from starlight, even if it's overcast, or the moon or a sliver of the moon, that you're going to see a silhouette of a 150 to 200 foot mast and sail on the horizon. Mm-hmm. I don't think you're going to ever escape that. I'm just saying. But yeah, it was kind of nice.
It stretched credulity a little bit. But anyways, after that, they make that move and they turn around. They get behind the Acheron. All of a sudden, they have the weather vane in their favor, and they're chasing the Acheron. And while they're chasing it, all of a sudden it skips to the rough weather where they're having trouble sailing because the wind's so strong. And yeah, they're heading towards it. And you have a feeling that they've been chasing the Acheron for days, but the movie doesn't really make it clear with how it's cut. Don't you think?
That's true. Well,
it's a little bit of a hard cut. I think maybe there was maybe 10 or so more minutes, or maybe 5, or maybe there was a little side story that got cut from the final film that had a bit right there that give you a sense of the passage of time as they're heading down past Argentina. So it was a little confusing. I had to take a second. It's like, where the fuck are they exactly?
Well, I think that, so the film starts out like off Brazil, and mm-hmm. then they head down around Cape Horn, and then they go off into the Pacific. And then mm-hmm. I guess they head south into the Roaring 40s or the Furious 50s or the Screaming 60s or whatever those latitudes are down there to get a jump on the Acheron because the winds are stronger. Although I'm not sure which way the winds go down there. But anyway, so they head south mm-hmm. to get like a heavy beat.
That's
on the
after
Acheron.
They have to head south. Do they head south after they go get around the horn?
Yeah. Yeah, they do.
But they go south because they can't handle the winds, so they're going around like a storm or something.
Oh, I thought they did that to get speed up on the Acheron, which is a
ship. No, I'm pretty sure that the first mate, his name? Poling, says that the ship can't handle the wind. So they decide to go around south. And everybody's like, oh, we got to go south. And then the next shot is everybody freezing their balls off in the ship covered in snow because they're so far south.
It reminded me of an awesome episode of the Animal Planet's Whale Wars. No, I'm just kidding.
Really? I meant to see the Whale Wars.
Oh,
I never watched that.
It's fucking ridiculous. You should watch it because that show made me eat minke whale in Iceland.
I like the idea of going around and harassing the Japanese whalers. I'm all for it. But I guess guys are really unlikable.
Yeah, they are completely unlikable and worthy of horrendous harassment. But the problem is that the Whale Wars guys, the Sea Shepherds, are so fucking inept. For starters, they're like dreadlocked indie musicians part-time. They're not seamen. Mm. And they kind of have a dipshit captain running the quote-unquote fleet. And so what they ended up doing is they end up chasing whale ships through ice floes with a ship with no ice rating. Everybody's a volunteer, and they're all hyper-zealous. And every time like they see a whale get harpooned, they do a collective cry on the deck. And it's just... Mm. I keep wishing that there would be like a swap of Deadliest Catch with Whale Wars where they would switch crews and see what's going on.
That'd be fun. But they're sort of hamstrung because they're working in a gray area of the law, so they can't really be too aggressive. They're just to harass, right?
Well, yeah. And I have my big problem with them is that the Japanese are, the Japanese whalers are more or less cocksuckers and they're doing it for profit, but they say they're doing it for research, mm-hmm. which is horse shit. But the thing is that what would be interesting to know is the minke whales a sustainable resource? And if so, if you quota minke whale catches, can you keep them sustainable? And I think Iceland has tried that, or they at least hunt in territorial waters and have some kind of assurance that they have a sustainable resource there.
Well, I think I don't think that's the point of the Whale Wars guys. They just don't think we should kill cetaceans. Is that those whales? I think they have a moral outrage against those particular animals.
Whales got to get in line behind all the other mammals that are being taken for food on this planet.
Well,
so
I mean, I think they're just behind monkeys about whether or not we should use them as a food source. I think we both agree that we draw the line. Let's not eat monkeys, right? Yes. I think the next one down are whales. And I think we can reasonably argue about whether it's morally right or not to kill them.
I'll say this. I had minke whale sashimi in Iceland.
Wasn't very good at it.
I didn't loiter in front of the restaurant the next day, waiting for it to open early so I could get a seat at the bar for another round. I was done.
I heard whale just sort of blows as a food stuff. That's why it's usually a food just of poor Aboriginal peoples in the northern latitudes.
Yeah, it's not good anyway. But yeah, if you want a real life poor imitation of the Acheron surprise pursuit, go ahead and head over to the Animal Planet and watch yourself some Whale Wars. It's funny. It's hilarious. Anyway, so then they head up to Galapagos, right? Which is a fuck-all trip from the Cape Horn.
Isn't that a long ways?
Yeah, it's like they all the way up off Peru or Ecuador or something like that. Yeah,
there's a lot of time compression going on in this movie, which is fine. This is just one of the things where the movie compresses, doesn't play real tight with the distances just to keep the action moving. I'm okay with it. It's pretty clear that they've traveled quite a ways north. I maybe would have liked to see some, you know, I thought what might have made this movie clear are some little cards when they sort of jump, do these time jumps, and say the date, and maybe have like a picture of a map or something.
Like or an old-timey map.
Have a convention where Captain Jack's looking over his map every time they jump great distances and times, where he's like a big global map where he's like, we're right about here. Just to keep you grounded in where they are, because I was a little confused a couple times, and it seems like that would have been a nice convention to sort of keep the audience aware of time and space, because they do play pretty fast and loose with it.
Right. Yeah, no, well, it helps the action tempo, you know, to keep things sped up like that.
And that's fine. They should never get rid of that. I thought they could add a little information for us to keep us on track of the time and space.
You have the interesting sort of pre-Darwin thing going on with the movie, which I found interesting with the ship surgeon, Stephen Maturin, where he's sort of an amateur naturalist. And
I don't think he's an amateur at all. I think he's a straight-up naturalist for the time. That was pretty much it. That was like top-of-the-line naturalist in the early 1800s.
Well, yeah, they didn't have disciplinary PhDs, so to speak, back in those days. They more or less had doctorates of philosophy or doctorates of natural philosophy, which is a much more...
Which you
more,
still have. Is what you,
well, that's what it's called.
Yeah,
that's what a PhD is, exactly. PH is philosophy and D is doctorate. But, yeah, you had a much more, what's the right word, self-directed disciplinary study in those days. And so to be a naturalist, you merely had to be an educated individual with a passion for that
field.
Well,
he was a member of the Royal Society. So basically he was a member of the Naturalist Society in the English-speaking world.
Okay. Well, why did that occur in this film? I always found that interesting, the whole Galapagos Darwin angle.
Well, I have a feeling they must have been paying, lip service to the larger character arc of Stephen Maturin in the books. In a way, the short amount of time they spend on it still works. That's one thing I like about this. You would think that sometimes when they try to compress too much information about a character beyond the scope of the short story format that is film from novels, it doesn't really work. But there's something about the portrayal of Paul Bettany's character that it just seems to work. You know, he's a skeptic in a world that is post-enlightenment, but not quite to the level of skepticism that exists
not
today.
To the average everyday man, that's for sure.
And he's a naturalist, and you know, you could tell he struggles with the idea of the natural world versus the supernatural world, which on a few instances I think it's just a real deft hand the way they present that character's skepticism about the world on several occasions. And I don't know, just from somebody who's, you know, sort of a poor man's modern naturalist and skeptic, I just found that a real pleasing portrayal of an early skeptic.
I also liked how it complimented the Jack Aubrey character, because he was willing to accommodate his endeavor as important, which you wouldn't necessarily get from sort of a lieutenant in the Royal Navy, somebody whose whole career in life is spent making war. But there is sort of this appreciation for higher intellectual endeavor that complements the Stephen Maturin character really well, which sort of makes it a much more believable friendship in my opinion, the mutual respect thing.
The way that they, you see Jack and Steven's respect for each other, but they don't spend a lot of time. They don't spend any time on the backstory. You don't know why they're friends, but they just present it that they have mutual respect for each other, and it has its limits, and they have their spats, but that the respect is always there. And at times, one will defer to the other out of respect.
It's a uniquely male friendship, I'll say that. It's definitely a friendship common amongst men, maybe not so much women or women at all. I don't see this sort of professional friendship. I don't know. You know what I'm saying? Maybe I'm being sexist.
I am not going to go with you down that path.
Okay, let's not. I will though. Putting my flag on that mountain, and you know.
It'd be a fine way to. You could certainly make that argument, but it wouldn't be a popular argument today.
Maybe not. But back then, you know, interesting point about this film: not one woman.
I tell you, some of my favorite movies don't have any women in it.
Yeah, me too. Glenn Ross, The Thing, Master and Commander. Wow.
There's something very simple about a world where there's no women. Oh, no, there is a woman in this movie. Russell Crowe sees that native woman off the coast of Brazil.
That doesn't count. That's so
and you, count. You know he's given up his family, the idea of having a family, for his career. Right, and he thinks, you know, there's a really neat wistful look in his eye when he thinks about what could have been. That he could have settled down and had a family, but he never has. I think that's a nice little moment where he thinks about the life he's given up.
Okay.
I think it's really nice.
Still, no women in this film, let's just be honest. There's like Glengarry Glen Ross has like a cocktail waitress in it, but she doesn't say anything. So there's really no women in that movie either.
Yeah,
you can split hairs.
There's
but
basically
whatever.
No women. That's good.
You're right. It is. It makes some of my favorite movies are women free.
Well, I think it's because we're guys. I bet a lot of women, some of their favorite movies are very female centric. I mean, they're movies that talk more to guys. If there's not any speaking roles for women in the movie, it's probably going to have more of a male centric interest and talk about ideas that are more pertinent to the male audience. And we're the male audience. So there's no reason we should be ashamed that these movies speak to us. They probably are meant to speak to us. Not that we can't enjoy, you know, the Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, which both of us really enjoyed.
Yeah, we mean to review that at some point here soon.
So.
Yeah. Oh, Steel Magnolias. All over that one. Yeah.
Exactly. Oh, man, when she runs into that young chick's car in the parking lot, she says she's got better insurance. That cracks me up.
Oh, man. Yeah. You're thinking of Fried Green Tomatoes, I think.
Is that Fried Green Tomatoes? I get those two confused sometimes. They're both two of my favorite female-centric movies.
Anyway, I don't know what misogynistic path we were headed down. But, that relationship I found probably the anchor, no pun intended, of the film, character-wise. It was important and fun to watch.
But I just think the way they draw it, there's a real economy to how they draw the Dr. Stephen Matran character. And I think with the sort of the minimal amount of screen time they really have, because there's so much adventure in this movie, I think they draw that relationship between Captain Jack and Dr. Stephen Matran really well. With just a few strokes.
Yeah. And that's kind of master storytelling right there where you're able to build whole backstories with clues. And part of that is respecting the watcher of the film to pick up on those clues and not beating him over the head with it. And that's sort of deft filmmaking and storytelling that is hard to come by, I think. And you don't get that very often these days, which is one of the reasons this movie got nominated.
Yeah, I can't believe it. It's a really nice direction by Peter Weir. And I guess he's had some great films in the past, so we shouldn't have not expected a really good film from him. And we certainly got a good film, though I haven't really looked at the rest of his oeuvre necessarily.
Did The Truman Show.
I really liked The Truman Show. I would have liked to do that one, too. They're both really... couple of my favorite movies. There's one thing I want to ask you about this. One character we haven't talked about, and if I can get my fucking window open here, I'd play the drop for you. So listen to this, and then let's talk about this character.
Okay.
The simple truth is, not all of us become the men we once hoped we might be. We are all God's creatures. If there are those among us who thought ill of Mr. Hollum, spoke ill of him, or failed him in respect of fellowship, then we ask for your forgiveness, Lord. And we ask for his.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, you know, it's a weird little side story in this movie, and it almost, in a sense, my first viewings of this film, this always sort of stuck out, the Holler character, as sort of a bit of a sore thumb in this movie. Why would they show, in a movie full of strong men and guys making the tough choices, that they put a weak character in the movie? I guess maybe it's as a foil to bounce the strength of all these other characters off of. But in a way, I sort of enjoyed it a lot more, this my most recent viewing. And I paid more attention to the character of Holler and sort of the internal struggle he has. And they sort of intersperse him over the film until about two-thirds through, where things come to a head for him as he gets pinned as the Jonah character on the ship due to some bad luck.
Well, he plays a dysfunctional crew member that is kind of at this point unable to reform. He's lost sort of the credibility with the crew, doesn't know how to get back to that point of credibility and or authority, and has to be ejected somehow. And it's almost biological. The crew's I'd call it a pseudo mutiny. They're not rebelling against, obviously, the captain, but their complete lack of faith in the Hollum character and their need to eject that dysfunctional component of the officer crew, because to me, it didn't seem like the crew was being sadistic or evil. Or even though it looked that way, especially when he's walking through and everybody gives him that mocking salute. But they don't. You can't have a ship function, a warship function, if you have an officer that doesn't command any respect. And all those men suffer in some capacity if they have an officer that isn't able to garner their respect. And so it seemed like almost like an organic biological function, this sort of getting rid of the Hollum character. And that speech or that eulogy by
was really nice.
Jack Aubrey kind of speaks to that a bit, and it speaks to sort of the weakness in us all. And he does sort of, blame the crew, but he also makes the point that we're all God's creatures, and some of us it's just kind of the way nature is, and we can only ask God's forgiveness for that and go on with our lives. So I don't know.
Well, you're right. There is a machine on the ship that needs to be fed by good working parts, and these working parts are the men. And it's right. It's just a shame. You see that there's a softness to Mr. Holler, and in a way, right at the beginning of the movie, this weak character is the one who saves the ship by a keen eye and spotting the Acheron through the haze of a foggy morning. Right. Otherwise, they would have been taken completely by surprise. They wouldn't have been beat to quarters. Now, it's true that Mr. Holland is a meek man, and he was hesitant to beat to quarters, and luckily another one of the officers took the initiative. But it was his keen eye that saved the whole ship to begin with. It's sort of a shame that the society as it's structured on the ship doesn't allow for a softer character. But this is the way life is, and I understand that. But it doesn't mean we can't pity him because the world
didn't have a
nicer spot for him, and to use his, he was a cog that was put in the wrong machine, basically.
Well, I mean, look, the world's full of pitiable individuals who are victim of their circumstance, and you know, like watching a gazelle get taken down by a lion on the Serengeti, it's pitiable. But that's kind of the way it is, and that's the way nature functions. And a ship is sort of a force of nature that has a certain ecosystem that must be maintained and nurtured. And if it doesn't, then it has to kind of die, so to speak. And that's sort of what happened to that character. At least that's the way I see it. He just wasn't cut out and had to, as a matter of a functional ship or a warship under those circumstances, met his fate or did the appropriate thing, as inappropriate as grabbing a cannonball and walking off the plank is, you know, I don't know. So,
No, it's sad. And it's one reason I sort of, like to subscribe to sort of the true definition of liberalism, where society should make an effort to let people find the place that works for them. And not simply to throw away the bad pieces, but find the spot for that particular piece.
And I would say that's not a warship during the Napoleonic era.
No.
So that place character. Is not a warship. Yeah, exactly.
So let's go see what Ebert had to say about this film. Ebert reviewed Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World, back on November 14th of 2003. He gave it a full 4 stars out of 4 stars, which, what do you think, but how common is for Ebert to give the top score? It's not like 5-10% maybe, if we're lucky, 5%.
I'd say that for this film it was worthy of that. So.
Yeah, certainly, yeah. Yeah, but he's not overly free with his 4 stars, nor is he overly stingy with them. So I think when you see a 4-star review, you can trust that it's probably an excellent film. And yeah. Ebert certainly felt that way here. He says that the movie is an exuberant sea adventure told with uncommon intelligence. And he says we're reminded of the well-crafted classics before the soulless age of computerized action, which you mentioned earlier. And he calls... the action brutal and intimate violence. I really like that intimacy of the violence. It's one the thing I really enjoyed about this movie. You really felt like you're in it.
Lots of glistening sweat and blood on the deck. Yeah.
Lots of shards of wood flying around your head.
Getting stuck in you.
Oh,
shit.
God. Can you imagine? Pre-antibiotics? It would be terrible.
Oh. Well, see, that watching this film, that's all I could think of. It's just like, oh, man. Fucking.
Man, they could really use some penicillin on this boat.
Oh, life before antibiotics. Oh, my God.
What a terrible, terrible existence. Well, I'll tell
Jesus, you.
You
could get like a splinter in your hand from some piece of the ship flying off from a cannonball. Uh-huh. That could be your end.
Yeah, they have to cut your arm off.
Cut your arm off, and then that even would be infectious, you know. So, yeah, Jesus Christ.
You'd have to be a strong 13-year-old to survive it.
Oh, my God.
He did mention the... as somebody in this time and place, that the Crow-Bettany duo is appearing again from A Beautiful Mind, which would have been fresh in people's minds at this time. He calls, several times during the review, he calls the Acheron a French warship, and that's just patently false. It's not a French warship. It's a privateer ship.
Is it a privateer? What is a privateer?
It's basically a private ship that's been given the go-ahead by a state to harass the possessions of another state. So basically the French allow it to basically be a legalized pirate as long as their piracy is for British-flagged vessels.
So they're like a seaborne mercenary? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, basically the idea is that they're given permission to basically, when that's what they're doing, they go around taking merchant ships, whalers mostly, in this movie. And they just take them, take their stuff, their whale oil, and burn the merchant ship or the whaler ship.
But the captain of the Acheron was French.
I think it's sort of a quasi thing, but it's not a French warship. And they make it pretty clear on a couple of occasions. he says they use an actual ship at sea, and they use some real tall ships for this movie, and you can really tell it. He says the director Weir creates a place so palpable that we think we could find our own way around. Just the way it shows the ship at sea, it just seems really honest, and I guess it is. He says that some of the scenes, such as the rounding of Cape Horn, are as good at or better as any sea journey ever filmed. So this is from a guy that's seen a lot of films. He says this is
I would agree
on the top of any filmed.
I can't think of a film that does it better, really, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. And he mentioned something that we didn't talk about is the way that the characters, the character of our two mains, Captain Jack and Dr. Steven, are sort of shown through the way they both are interacting with the one-eyed boy, Blackney, and grooming him in with their own values. And you can almost imagine that this character, as we said, he'd be very hard in the future, but maybe he'd be the ultimate ubermensch, one-armed ubermensch, taking the best parts of both of these two great men and synthesizing it into one.
Yeah, the thing is, I mean, he lost his arm in battle and stuff, but he's not necessarily a victim of trauma, and traumatized individuals really make kind of corrupted, fucked up, mm-hmm. I guess, poor adults. But this kid is just, he's taking, you would think that arm loss would hone or burnish his adulthood more so. And you're right. Complement both of those main characters, so you could almost make a movie of that character in the future.
Well, it'd be interesting. It reminds me of one really touching scene that I really like, though maybe it's slightly saccharine, but I think it's really well played by Russell Crowe, is where after the Blackney loses his arm, Russell gives him a biography of Horatio Nelson, also one-armed.
I didn't know he was one-armed.
Oh, yeah, he was. And actually, the movie pauses on a illustration of Nelson, Lord Nelson, at the front of the book, where you can see he has one of his sleeves pinned to his jacket. And I just, there's sort of a softness that you see with Captain Jack's interaction with Blackney. And I think that Ebert says, both men reveal their characters in teaching the boy. And that is how we best grow to know them. And I think we sort of overlook that element where they're both taking the boy under their wing, and we see some of the better parts of these two main characters of the movie through that.
Sure.
I think it's a really nice storytelling mechanic that maybe we didn't even really see, but we certainly got the feeling that Weir wanted us to see. To sum it up, Ebert says this movie is grand and glorious and touching in its attention to its characters. He says the movie's epic without losing sight of the human, and he's reminded of the way great action movies can rouse and exhilarate us. So he's calling it a great action movie, which I think it is.
Well, you can really fuck up. You could have really fucked this up big time and made an unwatchable mess. You know, and you could have made it like a Pirates of the Caribbean 5 or something. You could have really turned it to shit.
Movies are so the first movie's good. I fell asleep during the second one. Is there a fourth one? I didn't watch the third or fourth one.
Which is unfortunate because it was loosely based after one of my favorite author's novels, Tim Powers, on Stranger Tides. Which I haven't ever read because I just haven't gotten around to it. His novel Anubis Gates, Tim Powers Anubis Gates.
Yeah, I read that one. That's the only one I've read of his.
That's a fun fucking book.
That's a solid book.
So it's sort of unfortunate that it got muddled and turned to shit under the Pirates of the Caribbean.
I mean, there was banner. Nothing after the second one was so fucking horrible. I mean, I can't. That shows the worst of action movies, and this shows the best of action movies.
Both have tall ships.
But I thought that'd be a double feature to see. See the top and the bottom of action movies.
As long as you could condense the second Pirates of the Caribbean into about 10 minutes, I think that would be a good double feature.
Yeah, you probably could get about 10 solid minutes out of it. Right.
One thing I wanted to bring up before, anecdotally about the film before we head out here, is the guy who got brained and had to have brain surgery on the deck, mm-hmm. He had a tattoo on his finger, on his fingers. Did you recognize that saying that he had?
Yeah, hold fast. Fingers? He was a member of the McDonald's or the
McLeods.
McLeods.
The McLeods. But he didn't have a Scottish accent, so I was really confused.
Was a little weird. I wonder if that the hold fast saying was sort of co-opted by some seamen by the 1800s, possibly.
Well, I think the McLeods, just an FYI to our listeners, Mark and I, when we were on the Isle of Skye, went and visited Castle Dunvegan,
yes,
which is the seat of the Clan McLeods, which is probably one of the more famous clans of Scotland because they've had a continuous succession of clan chiefs.
Now, considering the clan chief now is just some wanker who lives in London.
Yeah, no, he's just some rich fuck who doesn't even spend any time up there. He's like, a businessman down in London or something. But the clan has had 37 chiefs, which are all in a succession, which is quite a succession of, I guess, leadership. Although, like you said, I don't know what the fuck a clan chief does there now other than come up and pose with the queen or something whenever she shows up there. But maybe they just the McLeods just kind of fanned out over the world. I mean, we have McLeods here in the States who are Americans. So maybe that's what this dude was. But he had the tattoo hold fast on his fingertips. So it's like, oh, it's a McLeod. And then he got
I think they show his knuckles twice in this movie.
Yeah.
The hold fast.
Yeah,
business.
They do. Yeah. Which is an interesting saying because I understand the hold part, but I don't understand. It's like an oxymoron. Hold fast. Is it like steadfast? Fast is a different root than what we're.
It means fast in the way of tight, or fast as secured. So hold securely, right?
Fast.
That's what it means.
Fasten, like fasten, right? Like your fasteners. You have fasteners.
That's just another meaning of the word fast to make
you're
secure.
Right. Like fasteners, fast in a sense. F A S T. Right.
People still use it to this day. That every once in a while you see it fast in that sense.
A fast is where you don't eat for a period of time. Maybe that's a little bit part of that too.
No, I think pretty much like if you're you're a college student and you're tying a mattress, futon mattress on top of your car, you try to get it nice. You try to secure it fastly on top of your car.
Hold fast to your futon mattress.
Yeah, hold fast to your futon mattress. Or thou shalt have to go to Pier 1 and buy another one.
That's right. Hold fast, young college students. Anyway. Next week, our film is The Graduate, directed by Mike Nichols, who also directed one of my other favorite films that I'd like to review at some point, Closer, 2004, which was a play adaptation.
Have I seen that?
I don't know.
I don't think so.
So, but The Graduate, 1967, is an iconic film starring, a 30-something-year-old Dustin Hoffman playing a 22-year-old.
So well, he has a boyish charm.
Yeah. So, a classic. Have you seen The Graduate?
Never seen The Graduate.
Get the fuck out.
Yeah. It's just one of those. Look, that's why I'm doing the podcast.
I guess,
I'm too lazy
man.
To go see a movie. I need an excuse to go see a film.
I guess this is your excuse to see The Graduate.
That's right. It's been my excuse for the last 84 films.
It's a young man who gets up mixed up with an older lady, so it'll be interesting here to get Mark's take on that one. Wink, wink. And,
you know, the ripe fruit is the tastiest.
Yeah, that's your. It's a quote from Zorba the Greek.
Zorba the Greek. Yeah, it is.
All right. Okay. Until next week.
We hope in a short time to see you again.